Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, February 27th, 2013, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Each week, we analyze and opine on the workings of the news media from the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism. I'm Mike McKean, director of the Futures Lab at RJI, and joining me this week are regular panelists Lee Wilkins and, sitting in for Charles Davis, Amanda Hennen from the J School's magazine faculty. This week, we're going to focus on documentaries in recognition of the 10th annual True-False Film Fest, which gets underway tomorrow in Columbia. Founders Paul Sturtz and David Wilson told the history and evolution of True-False in an interview with Ryan Famuliner on Monday's Intersection broadcast. If you'd like, you can watch it in its entirety by visiting kbia.org, mousing over the talk shows tab, and clicking on the Intersection link. So we're going to focus our time on personal reflections from Amanda and Lee, a couple of True-False junkies if ever there were, and we're going to recommend a few of the films on this year's schedule. Also going to consider the connections between documentaries and mainstream journalism. In related news, we'll ask why Oscar voters appeared to shy away from war stories in their pick last week for Best Documentary Feature. We'll look at a media clash over the TSA's treatment of a Palestinian filmmaker and Oscar nominee when he arrived at the Los Angeles airport. And if we have time, we'll consider whether Soledad O'Brien's move from morning anchor to documentary producer signifies a diversity problem at CNN. Well, Amanda, thousands of fans show up each year for True False, including quite a few folks from the School of Journalism, and way up on that list are you and Lee. So let's start out and ask you, what got you interested in the festival, both personally and professionally?
Well, when we moved here, it had already been going for a few years, and we were totally hooked with opening night. I want to say it was 2008. It was on In the Shadow of the Moon, about the first moon landing, and we were just completely hooked. Now I think we have something like 18 films reserved, which is complete insanity. As a professor in the journalism school, I have to say some of these films do my work for me. You know, we watch Restrepo every year and Journalism and Democracy. Some of the ones this year are just a gift in terms of teaching about issues of free speech, teaching about issues of, sort of spreading out control over who has a voice and who has a say, and just about storytelling.
So and in a little bit, we're going to get to some of the specific films that you and Lee both have on your list of must-sees. But let's start out, Lee, by having me ask you the same question I asked Amanda. Now, you've been attending True False even longer than she has. Why did you get interested in it personally and professionally?
Let's start with a professional, because it segues right off what Amanda said. It does do my work for me. It also makes me think about my work sometimes in much deeper ways. The line between True-False and documentary film and long-form journalism is sometimes non-existent and sometimes bright and yellow. And trying to figure out why you think what you think about that is really important. And since I teach ethics, there are all kinds of ethical issues that get raised in these documentaries. And because of the subject matter, they dig in a way that the average news story frequently does not. So that's on the professional level. On the personal level, I think I'm basically a sucker for movies and a sucker for narrative. And I don't read as much as I should about things that don't have anything to do with the Academy. So here I have in, 1 week, what is essentially a really tantalizing goad that makes me think about things that I'm not reading about, that look at subject matter that I really haven't thought about. And so I find it very enriching and very tiring all at the same time.
Well, while we're putting in plugs, I should mention that in conjunction with True False, that MU is sponsoring something. It's called the Second Annual Based on a True Story Conference, looking at some of those things you talked about, the intersections between documentaries and journalism. And that starts tonight, by the way, for our listeners. In fact, if you're listening to us live, you might want to decide to turn off the radio because the public screening of their first film, Invisible War, is coming up at 7 o'clock, just a few minutes from now. Also, they have a full program tomorrow. You can see it on the on our blog. There's also, you can just search for that conference name through Google and you can find a list. They're going to be talking with filmmakers, scholars, journalists, and if you're registered, of course, you already know about that. If you're not, well, I hate to tell you, but it's sold out already. But you can show up for an individual session a few minutes ahead of time, and if there's an empty seat, well, they'll let you in. So let's start out with one of the issues that they have on their conference schedule, and that's basically why documentaries, at least in their thesis, seem to be making a comeback at the same time when traditional journalism is struggling. And I wonder, Amanda, if you, first of all, buy that thesis, and if so, how do you explain it?
Well, I'm not the first one to say this, but I think documentaries often pick up where mainstream journalism lets off in terms of, you know, having the time to devote all of that, just time spent reporting, money spent reporting. Not that documentarians have a lot of money, but they usually commit for a longer period of time, and they just have the ability to get into the nuance. And with some of the films we're talking about today, they can take risks. We're going to talk about Pandora's Promise later, but science journalists can't go out on a limb like that in the same way that somebody who's making a documentary about climate change, essentially.
Lee, what's your take on that question of why mainstream journalism seems to be suffering a bit and documentaries are making a comeback?
I think there are a couple of reasons. One is that Hollywood and or its ancillary component parts, of which there are many, has figured out that they can make money with documentaries, and so they're willing to invest in them in a way that I don't believe was the case 20 years ago. I think there's also some stuff about, in a way, I sort of see documentary film as kind of the bleeding edge of what journalists are experimenting with. So documentarians for a long time have been experimenting with point of view, and actually so have journalists, but that experimentation has really worked its way into the mainstream in the last decade or so in a way that it just simply hadn't before.
Well, as both of you mentioned, it's really not a new issue, but it seems like every year at this time we talk on the program a bit about the tension between sort of the more traditional values of journalism that we still teach here at Missouri, you know, striving for balance, fairness, and the sort of point of view or advocacy journalism that's inherent in documentaries. So I guess I would ask both of you, is there room for both?
Oh, I think there's room for both. I went to the pre-True False conference last year, and one of the things that I was just startled at was that most of the documentarians who spoke considered themselves artists and thought that the word journalist was in some way denigrating. But the ethical issues that they were talking about, everything, you know, from privacy and all the rest of that sort of stuff, these are things that journalists actually have thought about for a long time. We've actually figured some stuff out. So I thought it was interesting that we've got a group of people who are coming essentially out of film, out of the humanities, out of aesthetics, doing what I consider journalism without some of the training.
Mm-hmm. And also, I think in interesting ways, holding each other accountable in the way that, you know, this group of focused people who are all focused on documentary making can do in a way that we can't in journalism because it's so broad. So you see a lot of critiques of each other that are really interesting and provocative. And I think obviously there's room for both. The closing film this year is partially fiction. I mean,
yeah.
There's a Gael Garcia Bernal is the actor in it, and it's reenacting, and it does have some archival footage, but
I want to come back to that specific issue in just a moment. But, you know, there is also this, I think we've seen it in our classrooms as a growing number of students and teachers and practitioners, and maybe even a growing number of members of the audience who actually prefer point of view storytelling, or at least, you know, they're saying that they believe that you can't really provide true fairness, balance, and reporting. So what do we make of what appears to be changing attitudes about these, quote, traditional values?
I don't know that they're changing attitudes about traditional values so much as I think it's the audience getting a lot smarter. Mm-hmm. Janet Saidi and I teach a class that uses a lot of documentary film, does a lot of work with point of view. And one of the things that we're trying to get our students to understand, and it really takes us all semester to get there, is that you can do a point of view film about any subject matter from multiple points of view. And the notion that you've somehow captured what is irrevocably true in any one effort is really difficult for young people to wrap their heads around. But I would suggest most of us as audience members probably have a lot of the same issues.
Well, what about sort of the blurring of boundaries, as Amanda hinted here, between documentaries and fiction? I mean, Paul Sturtz and David Wilson, who are the co-founders of True False, have spoken about their willingness, and they have, in fact, scheduled films that straddle that line. They blend real-life footage with dramatic recreations and actors. Is that okay?
Well, I think since False is part of the title, that anything goes. But I think that they've always been interested in that hybrid kind of narrative. And I think what Lee's point about it bringing up questions in all of us about, okay, well, do I believe this? Is there a point of view? Who's advocating what? Whose side is being told? I think that conversation is actually enriched by having some fictional elements.
And I mean, I guess, Lee, we've used dramatizations in traditional television news stories for a long time, sometimes more controversially than at others, but it's out there.
Oh, it's definitely out there. And because journalism is becoming more of a multimedia effort, it's out there in ways that I think we don't normally think about. So, for example, if you go to the New York Times, which you can now, and depending on what the story is, then you can see video. And we don't ever ask ourselves the question, is the video done from the same point of view as the written story at the New York Times? Mm-hmm. But in fact, that is an important question to ask yourself. And what wound up in the cutting room floor and, you know, what didn't. So there's all of these things at work.
So do either of you think that we need to do more here at Missouri to teach journalism students the value of documentary films or how to produce them?
I think certainly we are working on teaching some of the storytelling techniques that documentary filmmakers use. And I think we just share so many different elements with documentary makers that it's almost the same conversation with a different outcome in a way.
One of the things that we're having on Friday is the folks from The Left Coast, which is an audio documentary unit in Chicago, does some fabulous stuff. They come to True False every year, and they're doing a special presentation for our students of audio documentary. So we're trying as best we can to push that envelope in all kinds of very strange places.
Okay, well, now let's talk about some of the films that you most want to see at True False, your personal list. We're going to start with Amanda. You have on that list two films about the democracy protests in Russia. One is Pussy Riot, a punk prayer. The other is called Winter Go Away. And here's an excerpt from the latter.
Россия без Путина.
Россия без Путина.
Главное, нам сегодня не поддаваться никакие провокации. Нас будут пытаться сейчас выкинуть на какие-то действия неадекватные. Не надо.
Well, as you can tell, the trailer narration is largely in Russian with English subtitles, so we'll talk over the rest of the clip for those of you watching and ask you, Amanda, why you picked these two related films.
Well, the Winter Go Away film, I think it's a cheap joke to say that we are all ready for winter to go away right now. No, I was excited about this one. This has 10 journalists from an independent newspaper who are covering Putin's third quote-unquote extended term as president, and just sort of some of the echoes of authoritarianism that were going on during these protests of Putin, and this obviously relates to the Pussy Riot hooliganism and the charges there. And sort of going back to what we were saying earlier, these are stories that I, you know, grazed over, and now it's my chance to really sink my teeth in and say, okay, what happened with Pussy Riot? I saw that everywhere, and let's see 80 minutes on this story, for example.
I'm unable to attend those two films this year and would really like to, because I spent several years doing training in Russia at a time right between, you know, the falling of the wall and then Putin coming into power, and we were at a point where I thought Russian journalism education was moving in a direction of more freedom of expression, more multimedia training. And other than seeing a few of my friends on Facebook there bemoaning just how bad it is, I haven't had a chance to see much either. I think those movies would be a real opportunity to get some in-depth look at what the consequences are for what's happening there. Well, Lee, one of the documentaries on your list of must-sees is I Am Breathing, the story of Scotsman Neil Platt, who's paralyzed from the neck down. And he chronicles the last months of his life. Well, here's a scene from it where Platt jokes about getting a call from the local TV provider when he tries to cut off his service.
Hello, sir. I hear you're wanting to disconnect. Yes, that's right. Can I ask you why, sir? Because I'm dying. Right, sir. Would it make any difference if we just threw in 3 months extra free? At which point I shouted, if you could do that, Sunshine, get a better bloke than all my dogs to put together.
Well, a funny moment, Lee, but you suggested maybe a box of tissues might come in handy for this one.
Well, they probably will for me. I mean, you're right, Mike, when you say personal. One of the things I tend to do in True Falls is I tend to load up on very serious things. So by about the middle of the day on Saturday or certainly by Sunday morning, I'm just emotionally and intellectually exhausted. So I've sort of learned every once in a while to drop in something that I think will bring me joy, even if it's joy through tears. And so that's one of the reasons that I picked I Am Breathing is this is a film about, quote, somebody who's dying, but I really think it's about living. And so for that reason, I'm very, very excited to see it.
Let's look at the rest of your list and briefly talk about why you want to see, 20 Feet from Stardom.
Who doesn't want to see that?
Who doesn't want to be that?
Pandora's Promise. Tell us about the other films on your list.
Okay, well, Blackfish is probably it's going to make me furious. It's supposedly done from an environmental journalism point of view about what it really takes to keep a killer whale in captivity. I've been lucky enough to see a couple of them in the wild up in Puget Sound. I'm also one of those people who goes to gawk at them at places like SeaWorld. And so I thought, okay, maybe I really actually do need to know what's going on here. The other one that you mentioned, 20 Feet from Stardom, in some ways, this is the one that I'm the most looking forward to because it's about people who've been backup singers for rock and roll bands. I don't know anybody who hasn't wanted to be a backup singer for a rock and roll band. So if you've ever had even the slimmest glimmer of that ambition, it seems to me that this would be a good thing to see.
And what about Pandora's Promise, which is really environmentalists favoring nuclear power?
Every once in a while, in my view, you should go see something that runs counter to what you think you know and what you think you believe. And so I thought, you know, I know that there's an argument out there for nuclear power. I don't personally accept it, but maybe it's time to go back and at least take a hard and critical look at my own thinking. And I think that that's what Pandora's Promise at least promises to do. I hope it achieves that.
You had that on your list as well, Amanda.
I did. I'm willing to see anything that has a possible solution for climate change that is new and that we haven't heard of. I mean, this sounds like it's working in France. I have some of the same reservations that you do, Lee, but this looks like they're really tackling this head on. And as we talked about earlier, we know that science journalists, they have a hard time tackling climate change because they know they will be personally attacked.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, just viciously attacked. So this is a place where an exploration of these issues can occur.
Well, tell us briefly about the other films on your list. Which way is the front line here?
This is the True Life Fund film. So Tim Hetherington was killed doing some of this documentary work in 2012 in Libya. And we will actually, in this film, I believe, see some of what he was dealing with while he was trying to cover what was going on in Libya. Sebastian Junger is coming to promote the film. He is promoting the causes, or at least one of the causes that Hetherington was interested in, which was a school for the blind. And then they're also promoting basically a first responder for journalists in the field who are taken down. And I can't wait to see this because I loved Restrepo. His life, his work was so amazing. And just to see it really understood and sort of processed in this way is a gift. Also, Manhunt. I don't know if you guys saw Zero Dark Thirty.
Yep.
And obviously saw some of the debates about that and about whether it's endorsing torture and what really happened. And on the one hand, Bigelow saying, well, this is the first draft of history. And on the other hand, saying it's not a documentary. It's confusing. And so I gather that Manhunt is going to set the story straight on this.
Or at least they claim to be a documentary.
Yeah, exactly right.
So we'll see how it turns out. Well, while Columbia was gearing up for True Falls and another snowstorm over the weekend, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences was handing out Oscars. In the documentary feature category, the winner was Searching for Sugar Man, about an American singer in the 1970s who sold very few albums here, but became a folk hero in South Africa.
To many of us South Africans, he was the soundtrack to our lives.
Everybody I knew had his records.
that you can't get. The message it had was be anti-establishment. Really, the first opposition to apartheid, they'll tell you that they were influenced by Rodriguez.
But nobody knew anything about him. He was a mystery.
And one director who blogged anonymously about his choices in these different categories said, to win this Oscar, you usually have to make a film that makes people feel absolutely great or makes people feel like they want to slit their wrists. And Lee, he said he voted for Searching for Sugar Man because he felt like $1 million when it was over. What did you think?
Well, it was my favorite film from last year. I liked it so much that I actually wrote a case study about it for my ethics book. It brings up a lot of the issues that you did. There's actually some animation in this film because they couldn't get archival footage. It didn't exist. So you've got that. You've got a story that is well told, and how completely is it told? You've got a documentarian who ran out of money, so he actually slept on Rodriguez's couch in Detroit in an unheated house for a few weeks while he was finishing the filming. So one of the things I really like about Searching for Sugar Man is that it gets at all these issues in a package that I think is very tough to put down.
It also says something about how prescient true-false is in picking films.
See, my favorite was How to Survive a Plague, which was also a front runner in that. This is not at all to denigrate Sugar Man because I didn't actually see it, but How to Survive a Plague was just an amazing journalistic feat to pull together all of that archival footage and retell that story that made it so alive.
And I heard David Wilson on Intersection this week predicting that one of the films that was at True False would be a winner next year in the Oscars. So
well, it's, when I try to encourage my friends to come, that's what I say. As if you want to know who's going to be up for Oscars next year, come to True False this year. You'll find out.
Or if you want to lord it over your friends on the coasts that you've seen these films before they have, which is my main reason for going.
Well, three of the four films that were nominated this year for the Best Documentary Feature at the Oscars focused on war and conflict. After a decade of fighting in Iran and Afghanistan, I wonder if maybe American movie makers were just as tired as everybody else and didn't want to give prizes to downers.
I don't know if it's about giving prizes to downers. And again, I haven't seen all of these. I'm going to see one of them tonight. As it is that these films may have knocked each other out of competition. If you were inclined to vote for a film that raised these sorts of serious issues, not that I don't think Sugar Man raises serious issues, I do, but these sorts of issues, you had a fabulous set of choices, and conceivably that vote could have been split.
I have to wonder, though, I mean, and I'm not saying it's a good thing that people, that these movie makers didn't want to vote for downers in that category, but it seems to me if you look at what happened to Zero Dark Thirty, if you look maybe at even our daily news coverage and, you know, the way we tend not to be telling a lot of in-depth stories about what's still going on in Afghanistan and elsewhere, maybe we're all guilty of just a little bit of fatigue.
I think the Zero Dark Thirty situation, people are saying that was sort of an intentional humiliation to sort of, well, they got an award, but it was actually a split vote for sound editing. And so people, because at first when that film came out, it was critically reviewed very well. And then people said, wait a second, this is just a PR tool for the CIA. And I think it was intended to be a smackdown.
And to somebody who saw the movie, I didn't see that, but then everybody's going to see it their own way. Well,
I'm sort of obsessed.
a sobering thing happened to one of the Oscar-nominated directors in that category for documentaries. Imad Bernad is a Palestinian farmer who told the story of Israeli settlers who were building homes and a barrier wall in his village in the West Bank. He did it in a film that's called Five Broken Cameras. When Bernat and his family passed through screening at LAX, they were stopped by TSA workers who said that he couldn't produce the official pass that the Academy had sent him to prove that he'd been invited to the Oscars. Well, eventually he found it, and they let him go. A TSA spokesman, quoted in a single-sourced BuzzFeed story, says the whole episode took about 25 minutes, that it was routine and that Bernat was randomly chosen for additional questioning. Michael Moore, on the other hand, and some other folks accused the TSA of profiling. They said Bernat's movie is critical of Israel and his wife was wearing a hijab. What do we make of this? Was Bernat being treated unfairly? Was Moore just engaging in hype? was Glenn Greenwald, who was blogging about this right when he said the BuzzFeed reporter who relied on just one source was guilty of, quote, government subservient stenography. Who wants to take this?
Well, I was going to say, I'll go ahead and start because the quote that I most agree with, you put this on the blog, Mike, so people can go and read it for themselves. But in fact, this was a reporter who took everything that the TSA source said, didn't name him, problem one, took it at face value, problem two, didn't check anything out, problem three. Do I think that we were racially profiling? You bet. Let's be truthful about that.
I know for a fact that this very same day this happened, one of our former doctoral students was held at TSA, and it was a very unpleasant experience. I think this is happening all of the time. I think the fact that he was an Oscar-nominated director, you know, obviously brings it to the forefront. I'm having a hard time figuring out what actually happened between all of these different accounts. But I think it's something where when somebody goes through that and is willing to tell their story, you know, we need to listen to what they're having to say.
I'd like to hear more about it, too, because it seems to me what coverage I've been able to see about it so far sort of just flies over at 30,000 feet. It's all agenda-driven. I haven't really seen a lot of just hard reporting about what exactly happened and what multiple sources who are maybe not interested sources would have to say about it.
Well, if you want to make yourself really depressed, then read the comments on the TMZ coverage because that is – well, TMZ. But the comments there will just make you – feel a little sadder.
Yes.
Well, and here's one last story this week that's related to documentaries in the news media. As we briefly mentioned to you last week, new CNN president Jeff Zucker has decided to remove Soledad O'Brien from her morning anchor chair and sign her up instead to produce more documentaries. Now, O'Brien insists in the media that she's happy about all of this. Zucker says the move fits his strategy of producing more original long-form programming for CNN. But Lee, some critics are pointing to her ouster and also to Zucker's recent hires of Jake Tapper, Chris Cuomo, Rachel Nichols as proof that he really isn't all that committed to diversity at CNN. What do you think about that?
Well, diversity in what purpose? And I think we've got two here. The first is diversity in the visual image, which I don't mean to sell short. It is very important, especially in this country. But for me, the reason that we argue about diversity, at least in a First Amendment free speech sort of way, is so that there will be diverse points of view. You can hire 10 people who are all 7'8". And they may look very much alike in height, but if they have diverse points of view, to me, that really matters. So we've joined the part of the conversation that's about how do you look in front of the camera. We have not, as best I can tell, joined the part of the conversation about what is it in content that you create that epitomizes diversity.
Plus, I believe O'Brien was doing a lot of diversity initiatives behind the scene for youth who are thinking about broadcast journalism and so forth. And that's really important. And that's something we couldn't possibly measure.
She has been. And I have to agree with you, too, Lee. I think that really there is something to be said for the value of having your community represented on camera. Mm-hmm. But it's really much more important, for example, for Soledad O'Brien or people of color to be producing long form stories for CNN, for the producers who decide which stories get covered and how they get covered to be worked. Now, I'm not saying CNN has a great track record of this. I don't really know. But the focus solely on the people we see on camera, I think, is a mistake. And I hope we'll get some sense. And Zucker will perhaps talk at some point as he responds to all these criticisms about what CNN is going to do behind the scenes as well as in front of the camera. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. Thanks for listening and watching. You can look for audio, video, and related stories on our links blog under the talk show tab at kbia.org. We welcome your comments, questions, or suggestions there. You can offer them on the blog, or if you like, you can send them via email at views@kbia.org. Thanks to Amanda Hinnant for sitting in this week for Charles Davis, and thanks to Travis McMillan and Pat Akers, who produce our show from the studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. If you've bought one of those sold-out passes for True False, enjoy. If you haven't, you can still arrive an hour ahead of the film showtime, get a queue number, and with a little luck, buy a ticket on site. I'm Mike McKean. Please join Charles, Lee, and me again next Wednesday for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.